Welcome back to the Make or Break Show, where each week we bring stories of incredible makers and the make or break moments that have defined them along the way. I'm Chris Brandon-Cullum, and this week we chat with the one and only Jimmy D'Aresta. We dive into the world of working with sponsors and how it has evolved over the last decade, plus Jimmy's current multiple shop setup and answers to your questions. What is up, everybody? Welcome back to the show. Hope you're doing absolutely amazing. We have another fun episode for you guys. We are hanging out with the one and the only Jimmy D'Aresta. If you are in the maker world, more than likely you have definitely heard of Jimmy. He is more or less the godfather of the maker community. He has been on TV. He has a super successful YouTube channel, and he's been at this game for a really long time. And that's actually kind of what we get into this episode. But before we get into that, I want to let you guys know that we actually have a sponsor for this episode, and that is IsoTunes. In fact, they're actually going to be sponsoring this entire month of the next four episodes. We'll get into more details about what they're doing here a little bit later, but I want to let you know at the top that we are running a giveaway with them for a pair of their IsoTune Pros 2.0. And so IsoTunes, they make Bluetooth hearing protection, and so there are some great earbuds for working inside of the shop, and you still want to listen to music or listen to a podcast, and you don't want to blow out your ears, and you want to keep your ears protected. They do some really cool stuff. So if you guys want to check out that giveaway, it is makeorbreakshop.com/giveaway to check it out. Also, this show is brought to you by the awesome and wonderful supporters over on Patreon. The show would not be possible without you guys. Thank you so much for your support. If you guys would like to support the show and everything that we are doing here, as well as all the bills that we have over at the Make or Break Shop, you can head over to patreon.com/makeorbreakshop to check it out. All right, so getting into this week's episode with Jimmy. This is actually Jimmy's second time on the show. We had him on a little while ago. He's gone through quite a few changes. He's moved to upstate New York. He has multiple shops, which we get into, but we really get into his approach to sponsorship. So he was recently at a conference in Atlanta called Workbench Con, which a lot of you guys were at, and he had mentioned that he's been talking to a lot of people who are kind of up and coming. He calls them the freshman class in this kind of maker community, and how the approach to sponsors has changed throughout the years. So he actually gets into like specific numbers that he has had along the way, if you guys are looking at the content creation game. And then we also get into making and all of his crazy shops, and especially metalworking, and some Q&A there at the end. So without further ado, let's jump into our interview with Jimmy D'Aresta.
My neighbor is doing chainsaw work, so you might hear that.
Oh, really? That's awesome. Of course. Always when I'm about to record, there's always a someone leaf blowing right next door, which is a pain. but we're live now. But thank you so much for jumping on and chatting. As always, sure. Excited to get into. I feel like the last time we talked was a year and a half ago, or maybe 2 years ago. It was right before you're about to move, and I feel like there's been lots of changes that has been.
Maybe I was closer to 3 years ago. Yeah, like two and a half years ago.
That's right. Yeah, it was way, way back. So I know you're in an entirely new place and doing a lot of new stuff. But I would love to kind of catch up a little bit, maybe that people haven't been with you recently. And what is your like shop setup? You have multiple shops now, right?
I went from having my little tiny basement shop. Well, I always had my little tiny basement shop back in the day. And then I always had my little machine shop here at the house, the farmhouse. And then when I had to leave the city shop, I came upstate and I looked around for a rental that I would use as an interim shop until I built the one in my backyard. Now, I found a good deal on a 100 by 50-foot shop. So it's 5,000-square-foot shop. I rent it. I pay, I think, $1,200 a month.
Okay, wow.
Which is less than I paid in New York for about one-sixth of that size. So in New York, I paid about $1,600 a month.
That's crazy.
For my main shop, I wasn't allowed to use all those other rooms, but I always did. And the landlord just kind of gave up on telling me not to use them. But my shop was 15 by 30 feet and I was paying $1,600 a month for
that. That's wild. And you have another one for like blacksmithing too. Is that right? Or another area?
Okay. So yeah. So now that I'm up here full time, we put a 20 by 15 foot extension on the back of what I call the machine shop, the one in my backyard. And that's our blacksmith shop. It's open air right now. We plan on closing it anytime. And so that's the blacksmith shop. The machine shop has gotten more organized because I've acquired more machining tools, and I put them all there. And the reason that started in my backyard is because when I had the city shop, I couldn't buy heavy things and bring them down the stairs. So I would bring them upstate. And so every like few months I would do a machining project, and I would do it in my backyard when the weather was like tolerable, yeah, or if I was here in the summer. And so I slowly started using my machine shop. But now that I'm here, sometimes I'm at the rental, which, oh, and then in the meantime, I built the shop in my backyard, which is really mainly been used for classes. Okay. And in spending so much time in the big rental, we had it set up and decked out, and I had to put electric in it. I don't want to jam my handmade shop in the backyard full of all that stuff. I like the openness. Yeah. And as long as I could afford to have it, I have my big barn that I use for whatever. And it's also still not done. The walls are still open. We just put in headers for the second floor. I'll slowly start to do the second floor as money allows, because I'm building everything as I have money.
Yeah, that's...
You know, I'm not sure.
What... how long do you think it's going to be to have it fully? Or is it a thing that will ever be, like, totally finished?
Well, if I get an influx of cash, you know, if I get, like, another $25,000, $30,000, I'll just jump in. You know, I mean, the life of a freelancer, you know, I don't know, everyone thinks I'm a millionaire because that's what the internet says, but, you know, you make money and you spend it. You make money, you spend it to live, you make money, you spend it on rent, you spend it on mortgages, and I bought a second property, so I have to maintenance that with money, and, you know, I still have to earn my money. So it's still, you know, the life of a freelancer. It's like, oh, okay, I got money, let's invest it. I got no money, let's just stop buying machines. Oh, I got money, let's buy stuff. I don't have any money, let's stop buying machines. So that's... Let's not put the second floor in for a week. But maybe by this year, by the end of this year, I hope. I mean, if Hollywood goes as planned, I'm going to have 18 TV shows by next year. But I don't think any of that's going to happen.
Yeah, and that shop, that was the one R.R. Buildings did, right? He did, like, the structure and everything with all the drone stuff. And
the one in the backyard. R.R. Buildings, Kyle Stumpenhorst, built the building with Greg. And they left it unsided with no windows and no floor. And then David, the Mexican carpenter, came in, and his crew put in the floor, a heated floor, and they did the clapboard siding and the windows. And Patrick, my buddy Patrick Reynolds, did all the electrical work, and me and JD did the doors. And so there'll still be more stuff to do.
That's crazy.
Which will, you know, net result in videos.
Yeah. And so you said you had another rental. Is that where the racetrack is?
No, the racetrack I own, there's nothing going on there right now. Yeah, I bought that. That's what I'm saying. That's the property I bought in town. The rental is the 50x100 shop. That's the rental, the 1200 shop. That's where I am most of the time.
Yeah.
Like when I'm on Instagram and Facebook, like hanging things from a chain, taking things off my truck, that's almost always the rental. It's like kind of scrappy and it's got a porta potty out front.
That's amazing. So how many printing presses are you up to now?
About 10.
Good night. And that's all in the barn? Or mostly in the barn?
That's all in the rental. Yeah, that's all in the rental shop, the 100x50 shop. They're all in the back. But so the reason I ended up buying the racetrack is because Taylor said, hey, wouldn't it be nice if we had all the printing presses at like a cute old building in town? And there isn't any really cute old buildings in this town. And then the racetrack became available. And I was like, so I bought the racetrack with the whole intention of putting all the printing presses there. And there's a 50x50 Morton building on the racetrack, and I was going to turn that into my print shop and my memorabilia shop with all my YouTube builds. Yeah. So I was going to put all those hanging on the wall and stuff. So the goal is to take that, money and time permitting. I'm going to do that on an extreme budget, but money and time permitting, I'm going to turn that into like a Cracker Barrel type atmosphere with like an old school porch on the front. And that's going to be my print press shop and sort of memorabilia shop with like my swords and everything that I've made and knives and tools and any kind of thing that I could screw to the wall. I'll put it in there.
That's wild. That's you're all over the place. It sounds like this shop wise and tool wise.
The main goal, so I was like, if you go back 4 years, you would hear me talking, being like, I can't wait till I build my dream shop in the backyard. And it is a dream shop, but we spent so much money building it like a house. It's like a house now, and it's great. I have my plasma cutter in there. The floor is heated. This winter we were in there, and it's been beautiful in the dead of winter. And it's really been the receptacle for the classes. Whenever we do classes here at the house, we all hang out in that shop. So that has become the classroom. And then I realized I don't want to completely overload it with all my other tools. So I'm putting a smattering of tools in there. I have a lathe in there. I'm going to put my big new drill press in there. I just brought a table saw over today. So there will be like a full functioning shop, but it's going to be more of my classroom atmosphere for when we have classes. And then my rental, no one's keeping up with this, I don't believe. But my rental shop that I have, the rental shop that I have is directly across the street from the racetrack. And that's why. And so in time, I'm going to build a Morton building big enough to house everything in the rental. I'm going to move it across the street so then I will own the property and not just rent.
That's nuts. Yeah. That's so crazy.
Yeah, it's just a lot.
Yeah,
a lot
all that people. All that compared to the tiny space you had in New York,
in the city. But I also always had this house.
So you still do stuff up there, though, right?
Yeah, okay. Oh yeah, I do. I do client work here all the time. I mean, this house is where I now live full time. But I bought this house 6 or 7 years before I ever did YouTube. So
gotcha. Okay.
Yeah. So I actually bought this house before I joined YouTube. I bought the house in 2004. I went on YouTube in 2006, and then I actually started really working hard on YouTube in 2011.
Yeah.
So everybody thinks I made this house. I bought this house with YouTube money. I always own this house.
Got it. Got it. So speaking of YouTube money, kind of how this came about. So on, I forget what episode it was, probably 2 episodes back of Making It After Workbench Con, you guys were talking about like the freshman class in the maker community. And for folks that don't have any reference to Workbench Con, it's a big conference for YouTubers who also make. And you guys were talking about how, I guess like the approach to sponsors, whether or not that has change like how you do it, or kind of how it's changed since. I mean, because when did you first post to YouTube? You've been
I first started well in this current life that everybody knows me, and I knew I'd put up a video of me building something.
Right.
Started in October 2011. That was my first video that I posted. Yeah. And prior to that, there's like videos of me goofing off in my backyard with guns, and you know, so it's kind of looks like the Jackass TV show, but. which was my inspiration. But when it comes to this current life, posting videos and developing a relationship with the fans and advertisers started in 2011. But I didn't really, my first so-called sponsor, you might say, would be Make Magazine, because they were paying me to make videos for their channel. But and their audience started coming over to me. So that was my first big break. And then I guess it wasn't until I had about 100,000 subscribers, at least, when my first sponsored video, I guess, would have been the DeWalt video that I recall, where I made like a wooden toolbox with DeWalt's logo on the top. And that was a weird deal because they came to me, but they didn't know anything about sponsorships or influencers, because as far as I know, and they told me this, but I don't know if I was talking to one person who knew or didn't know. They said my deal with them, which wasn't much of a deal, was their first sort of influencer project. You know, for YouTube. I'm sure they have influencers outside of, you know, what we do. So when they came to me, they said, how much did you want? And we negotiated a $1,200 price. So that was my first video. It was $1,200. And I did that video for them. And then they didn't approve it for months. Like 6 months went by. And I was waiting for approval so that I could publish it. And then I finally called them. I was like, look, guys, if you guys don't want to approve this video, or something you think is weird about this relationship, I said, that's fine. Don't pay me. But I'm going to publish the video anyway because I made it and I own it. And and they're like, no, you can't publish it. Not until we correct one thing. I'm like, then why didn't you tell me that? So then, there was one stupid thing where my hand was too close to the saw, which was completely stupid. So anyway, I edited out that little piece. They approved it and I published it. And then it took them several more months to pay me $1,200. So like almost like I made that video, I didn't get paid for like almost 8 months until they actually paid me. And they paid me with a credit card because they didn't know how to pay an influencer. So I opened up a credit card account with, you know, I guess Square, you know, the credit service, so that they could pay me. And it was just so weird. I published that video. Then I guess the very next thing that I can remember getting sponsored by was True Fuel. I did a video where I used chainsaw and used True Fuel. And then I started realizing, like, I got annoyed with the Lincoln thing. And it was nice that they came to me. They offered me, like, $2,000 for video. I told them, forget it. I would only do it for $5,000, and that would be it. I said $5,000 because I didn't have anything to lose. I didn't, you know, there's only one sponsor. If I lose that sponsor, there'll be more.
Right. And how big was your channel at that point?
Somewhere around 100,000. Somewhere around 100,000. And they came back and said, okay, we'll do it for $4,500. And I said, okay, that's cool. And I said, I gave, they were very reluctant at 45. And I said, I'll make a deal. I said, I'll shoot the video with your logos and I'll do your thing. Oh, because I said I didn't want to read a script. And they're like, no, you have to say certain things. I was like, I'm going to do it my way. and I'm going to put your logos in and give you guys a lot of screen time. And if you don't like it and you don't want to do it, I'll just take all your logos out, take your product out of the video, and I'll publish it anyway because I was going to do a build video. And they agreed to that, and then they did pay me. But I gave them the out. I'm like, I need this video. I need a video. I'm not going to waste my time making a video and not publish it simply because your logo's in it. I'll just remove your logo if you don't want to pay for it. And this was in the beginning. Like now anybody might come to YouTube and say, oh, I definitely want to do a video. Let's negotiate on how we do it and how much you get paid. And it's a thing. It was early on. You know, other people, they were makeup people getting tons of endorsements, but it just seemed weird in the maker space. And I'm not saying I'm the first person. I'm sure King of Random was getting paid early on from weird places. I just wasn't paying attention. And I'm sure Colin Furze always has been getting paid from the beginning. But when me, Bob, and Dave started collecting money, I even one time behind the scenes, I told everybody, I wrote an email to Izzy, April, who else? Bob, Dave, and maybe one or two other people. I said, if any companies approach you, let's all just say the video is $5,000. That's it.
Yeah.
And so, because these companies would bounce around to all of us. They'd offer me this much and Bob that much and Dave that much and that because of the various size of, you know, our subscriber count or our view count. And I said, it doesn't really matter because, you know, that this little tiny horse race that they're putting us in is ridiculous. It's just a way for them to negotiate. In all actuality, everything we're doing is worth tens of thousands of dollars because we're doing a very pointed marketing campaign. And, you know, any company would pay tens of thousands of dollars to market directly to 25,000 people, you know, if that was the size of our audience. And all of our audiences were bigger than that. And they were only offering us anywhere between $1,500 to, you know, $3,500 to $5,000. And that's why I said to those guys in an email, I was like, these certain companies are going around hitting each one of us. Let's just all say the same number. And then, you know, let's just take like a year and just say absolutely this way or no way. And I don't know if those guys remember that, but I do remember composing that email and sending it to everybody. And then when people come back and say, oh, you know what, I'll give you 1,200, no, 5,000. And then they go, how about 4,200? And then you go, okay, you know what, that's reasonable. You know, if I didn't say anything, I would be stuck at 1,200.
So how is it shifted then from having to explain and almost like the product line and the value to folks to now you have whole conferences to teaching people how to do this type of stuff? And I'm sure there's like actual like in between folks. Like I know you work with an agent and I'm sure there's agencies that folks
so
go through
it's
now.
Like, funny. It's funny how I got my agent. So I've told this story a few times. Right after I did the TV show Dirty Money, a friend of mine got a successful show on the Travel Channel called Baggage Wars. I don't know if you remember this show called Baggage Wars, where guys would auction. They would go to auctions for stuff left at a carousel at an airport. And I'm sure 90% of it was faked, but there'd be bags and guys would auction bags.
That's fun, yeah.
And you would, okay, I'll buy that bag. It looks, and then you open it up and it's dirty clothes. You know, or you open it up and there's antiques in it. It's, you know, it was, I'm sure it was 90% staged. My buddy Billy was on that show and Billy got an agent. And so in 2011 or 12, Billy's like, you got to meet my agent. His name is Mark at Abrams Artist. So Billy set up a meeting with me and Billy and Mark. And I went in and saw Mark. And I was a bit snarky because I was still mad about Discovery Channel. And I had already made a few YouTube videos. And Mark's like, I don't know what you want me to do. You make these videos. You don't talk. You know, TV's all about talking and responding to people. And you making these videos, I don't really understand like what you want from me. And I was like, I'm just meeting you because Billy pushed this meeting. And that's it. Now I'm on your radar. You're on my radar. You know, all the power was in his hands. It wasn't up to me to decide whether I wanted him as my agent. I don't make that decision. He makes that decision. And so for the next few years, he would send me on casting calls. Now, in the old days, you'd actually have to go meet somebody. But by this point, casting call meant just Skyping with somebody. Yeah. And so that's all it means now. You Skype with somebody and you see if you have chemistry or if you suit the needs of whatever it is they want. And I went on several little casting calls and I was always very like very doubtful and none of them led anywhere. And actually, so now several years go by and I probably have like 250,000 subscribers at this point. I guess it was about 4 years ago. And Mark sent me on a casting call. It's like, hey, would you be interested in taking this? I'm not even making this up. Bakery makeover, where you would be like, you know, I'm a little older now and I'm a little chubby now, but at the time he's like, you'd be like the hunky, You'd be like the hunky carpenter on Bakery Makeover. It'd probably be a couple of designer guys would be
right
making over bakery shops, and I would be like the sexy carpenter in the background building shit. And the pilot paid $1,000, and it would be a local hire for $1,000 a week, which would mean I'd have to make my own way to California.
Oh, wow.
To be on this show to get paid $1,000 a week. And I was making already a lot more than that in my regular life as a fabricator, a lot more.
Right.
And a lot more on YouTube. And I had remembered I was super cocky because I had a really successful video and I made about $10,000 on AdSense that month. And that's what happens. You know, sometimes most often you make like an average of like, you know, a few thousand dollars or five or $4,000 at, you know, when you're getting 5 or 6 million views a month. Sometimes you get 10 million views a month, and that's when you make a big lump of money. Anyway, so I had just come off of that month, and he sends me on this thing, Bakery Makeover. And I wrote back to him. I'm like, I just made $7,000 or $8,000 working from my house, and I don't have to go anywhere, and I don't have to talk to any producers. I was like, this is ridiculous. Yeah. I said, thank you, but this is ridiculous. I was like offended, like in a way. And about 2 hours goes by and my phone rings and it's a strange number from New York. Hi, this is so-and-so, Mark's assistant. Mark's on the phone for you. And I was like, oh, he's going to yell at me for being snarky in the email. And he goes, hey, Jimmy, it's Mark. Remember me? I'm like, of course I remember you. You send me on. But he always sends me on casting calls through his assistant. I never actually ever spoke to him. And I'm like, yeah, what's up? He goes, I just looked at your YouTube. You're doing really well. I'm like, yeah, I know. And so this is like almost maybe 3 or 4 years after our first initial meeting. Yeah. And he's like, hey, you know, we just started a YouTube division here at our agency for YouTubers. Would you be interested in being part of that? I was like, yeah, well, I'm not going to say no. Let's have a meeting and see what happens. And so shortly after that, about 2 or 3 months later, we signed a deal. And he's been my agent ever since.
That's cool.
Yeah, so that's how I got an agent, is him sending me on little casting calls. I think what he was trying to do is before he ever signed me as like a stable person inside of their acting stable or their whatever, influencer stable, he wanted to get me on a show. So he was trying to sign me. So he kept sending me on all these things, you know, like,
got it.
Will it sell? You know, all these ridiculous, they're mostly house shows. And I kept telling him, I'm like, I am not a carpenter. I'm not a bathroom makeover guy. I'm not a light switch replacer. I am a creator that creates interesting objects, sometimes furniture, sometimes tools. And he didn't get that. He didn't know how to like fit that into a TV show. Like the best thing for me would probably have been Monster Garage, but that never, you know, that was like before my time. And so now he's my agent and he's finding me all these little things like Dollar Shave Club. And at Bob Claggett, I give Bob the credit for urging me to do vlogs or something like a vlog. Bob didn't say you need to do vlogs. Well, Bob basically said you need to find a way to talk in your videos. Mm-hmm. And one thing led to another, and I realized the vlogs were a way for me to talk. Vlogs are a way for me to talk and then also a place for me to put ads. So that's why almost like maybe, you know, aside from like the product placement like Lincoln Electric or Ferd grinders or, you know, other stuff that I use in the videos, most of my ad income come from me doing the vlogs and doing that 1 minute commercial in the beginning of the vlog.
Yeah,
it's integrated. It's after because they never wanted it at the very beginning. So I do a little intro, like a 1 minute intro of just me having fun with edit, some fun music. And then I go, hey, everybody, welcome to vlog number 87 or whatever. This vlog is sponsored by. And then I do that 1 minute ad. And that's how I was able to incorporate ads into it. And Mark and his team got me most of those ads because the NordVPN puts the feelers out.
Right.
Dollar Shave Club puts the feelers out. You know, all these weird little companies put the feelers out. I don't even know, Skillshare and, you know, all these companies. And a lot of companies come directly to me. And that was what I was talking about. I was talking about at the Workbench Con is like how you kind of got, you got to go to the dance and wait outside, wait on the edge of the dance for the girl to come and ask you to dance. If you do that, you have a better negotiating stance than as if you walk up to the girl and clumsily say, hey, can I dance with you? And she'd be like, oh, this guy's desperate. You know, I smell the desperation on him. It's the same thing with companies. If you just hang back and wait for the companies to come to you. And it's nice to have an agent who can field these companies like Dollar Shave Club and these companies that otherwise wouldn't necessarily knock on my door. But most of them do. And when they knock on my door, I just forward the email to Mark and Mark handles it. Mark's my agent. But sometimes companies come to me and they don't have any budget. And so I'm like, well, what can you, I don't want to say no, but if you can give me free tools, or if I can make a video for your channel, like I do with, Weaver Leather, you know, I'm always looking for those private label video clients where I could make a video for somebody else's channel. Those are always fun, and it's always a small, steady stream of money. So I developed that relationship at Weaver. And like I said, they didn't have a huge budget. My agent probably wouldn't have wanted to deal with them because it wasn't enough money for them to really take a piece of. But I'm happy to work for Weaver, and I do a video for their channel every couple of months, and they're happy, and I'm happy.
Yeah, and that's kind of what you did with Make way back. Right.
Yeah. I like getting clients that I can do private label videos for. And I mean, I'm lucky enough to have that in my back pocket. Now, I mean, unless, like, I know Bob made private label videos for Lowe's, but I don't think Bob would be so quick to make them for anybody but his own channel. And that's, you know, I think his brand is very stable in that way. I think he's good. But me, I'm always like a little bit like, oh, let me hustle and see what else I can get. Yeah. So, you know, I've approached a lot of companies and I say, hey, I'll make a video for your channel. And I have a good track record where I can go show these other channels where my videos are always very highly rated on those channels. And it brings my fans to them. And then when I repost it on my channel in a year from then, I always say, you'll get a second hit. I'll post it on my channel a year from now. And, you know, you get a year of exploiting it on your channel. And then I post it on my channel and a lot of my fans will have never seen it. And that you'll get a second boost because everyone will see this is the product from this other person. It's another product endorsement. And then you always have the fans that say, why am I looking at this again? Why are you showing it to me? It's always a small amount, though.
So this episode is brought to you by the awesome folks over at IsoTunes. I've actually done some stuff with them in the past. We did a giveaway about 2 years ago, and we got another one going on right now. I mentioned at the top of the show, again, that is makerbreakshop.com/giveaway. It's a pair of their IsoTunes Pro 2.0. But these things are pretty sweet. So not only are the Pro ones, they have a wire going across the back, but they're wireless, but they actually have full-out wireless headbuds that I have been playing around with, and they're super handy. And how these are great is they are set up for people that are working in a shop environment. When I'm running my table saw and it's super loud, or I'm especially running like a jointer or a planer, it's really nice to have these on because first off, I can hear and I'm not killing my ears, but then I'm not having to blast my music or most of the time podcast just to be able to hear over on top of that. So you can keep the levels low and you can protect your ears. I encourage you guys to check them out over at IsoTunes. And again, enter the giveaway over at makerbreakshop.com/giveaway. All right, back to the show. So going back to, I guess, the folks that are just starting, and you're talking about waiting on the outside of the dance.
Yeah.
Is that, but then on the flip side, people are like, but I need to make income somehow. Like, how do you like approach that when people are asking
the way it always starts? And, you know, someone like Derek, I love Derek from Alden. Derek's starting small, and he starts developing a relationship with somebody. You know, you go to like a Workbench Con, or you just can email anybody. Obviously, you can probably get through nearly mostly anybody on Instagram or Twitter, and you say, hey, I have a small channel, would you be interested in working with me? And you keep it vague, and then when you actually get into a conversation with them, they might not have a budget for somebody so small. You know, they're not going to give you the money they would give to me or Bob or Dave, but they would say, we have free product. Would you be interested in, you know, if you have like 10,000 subscribers, we'll give you a free product. X-Carve did an amazing thing a few years ago. If you had at least 10,000 subscribers and they liked you, they sent you an X-Carve. And when you do the math, if they gave out 100 X-Carves, that's $100,000 in product, which probably cost them less than that because that was the retail price. So let's say that cost them $50,000 or $60,000 to literally mail out 100 machines. They got so much exposure, and they still do.
Right.
Those machines still pop up in people's videos. And so that was really smart of them. That was kind of, that's what you call micro-influencers when you deal with. So smaller guys actually have a pretty good chance these days of at least making a little bit of money because they'll look at a guy like me and say like, oh, we got to give him $20,000 for video. You know what? Let's spread that across five other channels.
Got it, yeah.
Or 10 other channels that are smaller, and you cast a wider net, and they have a bigger chance of any one of those guys becoming bigger, as big or bigger than me or Bob. And so you do have companies doing micro influencers. It seemed like Lowe's was doing that. Like they were giving me a big number, and I'm sure they gave Bob a big number. And then they pulled it back from me. They let me go first. And then they started, I noticed they were giving a lot of other YouTubers. And, you know, I talked to one of them. I don't want to say who, but he's like, oh, they give me like less than 5,000 a video. He goes, but I have like four or five videos to do with them. I'm like, that's great. Yeah. Whereas they got one video out of me for $20,000 or more.
Right.
You know, they get five out of this small guy, but they do that across the board, and they get so much more for their money. So, you know, being as big as me, it's, you know, it's a double-edged sword. It's good and it's bad. It all depends on, you know, the friends you make and the people you influence. You know, it's all, and that's what's good about this business is that every one of us has our own unique relationship with our advertisers. You know, like the relationship Bob had with Lowe's is exclusively much different than the one I had with Lowe's. I was going to do a podcast for them. That's how I got in touch with Lowe's, and the podcast didn't work out. And so they said, well, we've already signed a contract to give you X amount of dollars. What do you want to do for that? And I was like, well, I'll just do what I do best. I'll make videos for you. And they're like, okay, cool. And so I made videos until my contract was up. And they actually saw a little bump, so they got excited. And I did a couple of tips videos. If you remember a year ago for going into Thanksgiving, I made two tips videos for them to promote some of the products in the store.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay.
They asked me, they're like, hey, we see these tip videos you're doing with a cat. Would you do two for us? I was like, sure, why not? Well, I'm not going to say no to money. And
that's
so
funny.
So I was like, I said to them, I go, hey, if you want to sponsor all the tip videos going forward, that would be great. And they didn't bite on that. But it comes and goes. You know, these relationships come and go with personnel changes. And of course, most often with budget changes, but personnel changes too. Somebody leaves one job, goes to another job. I mean, that's how you end up with, you know, a fan of yours starts a job at a new company. The first person they call is like, I've always wanted to call you. Now I got a job where I can exploit what you do. Let's make a deal. And, you know, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I know a thing that a lot of you guys will preach is that you can't just be in one area. Like you got to diversify. Like I feel like you, especially you have your hands in a ton of things. And so one of the things I know you've been talking about a little bit, but I know you make product, but also you're getting into clothing and apparel. Is that right?
Yes.
We're
making pants. I haven't offered it for sale yet because we're making them literally by hand in New York City. They will be made in New York City to order. And we're having zippers manufactured. We got to have like 2,000 zippers on hand. So the zippers we're having made, I don't know, like if we sell 100 pairs of pants, we'll break even. That's what we've realized. If we sell 500 pairs of pants, that would be unbelievable. Me and my partner would hug each other and that would be great.
That's cool.
And Christine is the designer. You see her on some of my Instagram stories. I only wanted to do pants to just maybe jumpstart a licensing concept. I want to basically go to like a client and say, look what I'm doing. I've done this. I've sold, you know, I opened a sales window for 4 weeks and we sold, you know, X number of pants. If you guys put some muscle behind it, we can sell X number of pants using my marketing power if you guys see it fit as a fit. And so that's really why I went into it. It's cost a lot of money, and I'm just hoping we can make our money back. But until we know the window, we also have to book time at the factory. So we have to tell the factory is going to be like, okay, for the whole month of April, we'll make all the pants you sell in the month of March. But we've got pushback because the zippers are taking too long to make. But the clothing business is complicated, and the lead times is such a pain in the ass. That's just why we haven't offered them for sale yet.
Yeah. And then another piece I feel like that throws way back to when you were teaching is you're teaching again, but totally on your own terms with your workshop. So was last year, was that your first season, I guess, or kind of the first year of running them, especially from your place up there?
Our first class we did was about 3 years ago. We did
a
camera class, and that was the first class of guys that came up here. I'm still friends with mostly all of them. And then we did a few more the following summer. And then this last summer we did 10 classes. And
that was a ton last summer, yeah.
Yeah. So last summer was like, let's just see if we could do this. And it was a giant pain in the ass. I mean, I loved the classes. We had a great time. The students were all fantastic. Nobody got injured. Everybody left happy. I'm pretty sure mostly everybody left happy. And a lot of repeat customers because they don't want to miss the party. A lot of people realize how much fun it is to be here. And it's not because I'm singing and dancing. It's just it's a great environment for great people to get together. And, you know, we provide an environment for cool people to come and share. And, you know, the friendships that are developed here are amazing. And, you know, I'm so proud to be part of that. but it's a pain in the ass. And, you know, catering and making sure everybody's like, you might have heard me talk about it on the Fitzall podcast, where I can't go to sleep when the house has 15 people in it.
Right.
Because I'm like the night watchman. I want to make sure that, and with 15 people in a 230-year-old house, you know, outlets are getting used for the first time in months, and you know, everyone's flipping on heaters. And so I'm literally like, I don't go to sleep until 5 a.m. because I can't. I'm like afraid the house, like, God forbid, there's a, like, you know, a gas leak, you know, and, you know, so it's the anxiety of that. And so just being a host is extremely stressful. And nobody ever saw that. Nobody ever saw, you know, the struggles me and Taylor were going through behind the scenes. But that is why we're just a little reluctant to set up a schedule this year. But that being said, I spoke to the friends at the Blackthorn, and I told them, if you guys want to do the classes, they're like, whoa, we won't be stepping on your toes. I'm like, no, let's do the classes at the Blackthorn. You guys can open up the classes to 25 people. I'll be there the entire time. I'll be, you know, I jokingly say I'll be the queen of the ball, and I'll be there with everybody hanging out because I'm just down the street. They have 80 bedrooms that they could rent. Right. They have catering on spot, and they have, you know, barroom dancing. So they have a much bigger facility. And, you know, when it comes to tools, me and Austin can put together any classroom we need, especially I have everything here. So it's a little less intimate because you're not in my house, but it's a little less stressful for me and Taylor.
Yeah, you get to offload, it sounds like, the part you didn't enjoy as much.
Yeah. I mean, like, I love every aspect of it, but just, you know, me and Taylor arguing over what to feed the guests and, like, catering comes and it's not what we expected and there's 10 people ready to eat. We're like, wait a minute, this doesn't look like the picture that you sent us last week, you know. And so it's just the struggles of running, you know, behind the scenes. It's just the way it is.
So has, even going way back to when you were teaching in New York, has how you approach the workshops changed? Like, when you're taking a topic and you're trying to teach someone how to do it in a short amount of time, like, has that kind of evolved over the years and just how you approach teaching?
Well, it's funny because that's why we, if someone's going to be here for 2.5 days, I want to make sure they leave with something or two or three things. So that's why blacksmithing is really good, because you can make a couple of bottle openers, a hook, a stick, you know, you get the basics down, and that's really good. The blacksmith classes are really successful because they always fill up. And the knife making classes are great. Steve has been a great teacher. Steve Pellegrino has been our teacher, and he's awesome. And everybody leaves with at least two knives. And so those are really good because you leave with two really good utilities and not necessarily like a vague maybe that, we haven't done a leather class. We had one scheduled, but the teacher had to cancel for her own personal reasons, and that was totally fine. And so we didn't do a leather class yet, but we're talking about doing the first one at the Blackthorn. We don't have the schedule set yet, but and what else? So that really is the main focus, is making sure people leave with something. The woodworking class has been bowl making and spoon making, and that's been great. And leaving with an axe handle, you know, the draw knife class with Tracy and Katrina has been great. People get to leave with a, you know, I have boxes of axe heads, so I let everybody pick an axe head, and you make a handle for that axe head.
That's cool.
And you get to sharpen it, and, you know, it's just not that we did do an axe head making class with Alex Pohl from England and his team, and that was great. But it was very, very specific. Everybody had a very specific piece of material, and you had to follow along there. You know, we did a freeform blacksmithing class with Chris Cash, and that was great too, but everybody freeformed and they got to make what they wanted. Some people made like twisty sculptures, and, you know, and that was great. So they're all good. I wish I could do it every single weekend, but I need a team of behind the scenes, you know, instead of just me and Taylor. And Brett helped out great last summer, but he's not going to be around this summer.
So the other area that I know you're deep into and I feel like you're always talking about, but I'd love to know kind of how it's changed. So you mentioned TV a bunch, and I know it feels like you said you're casting for like 50 shows right now.
Yeah.
That's a joke, but I know you do have a lot of feelers out there. Has that evolved over the years too, since you're like, you were on TV to now?
It seems like the casting people think of me more now, like this last season. Like, going into right now, this is when the shows really start to get solidified, like March, April, May. But I am currently in the running for 4 television shows. One of which is Making It, which I would definitely be on if it gets picked up. At the moment, they say it's picked up, but they haven't placed an order yet. You know, this is more technical behind-the-scenes stuff. Last I spoke with the producers, they said NBC hasn't handed down the order. And when they hand down the order, that basically means the wheels go into motion, the budget starts getting hammered out, and then they start doing a contract. And I, at the moment, they said maybe May and June. We don't know yet, but I was like, all right, if it's May and June, you got to let me know. And now the Assembly Required wants me to be on the show. I don't know. I know they want a couple of other people in the YouTube space, and they're going to pick one of us. They're not going to pick all of us. So I don't know who's going to get that position. And there are two Netflix shows which I'm up for. One which is really starting to heat up, and one which has been lying dormant, but every time I ask, they're like, yeah, we're still thinking about doing something. So they all can't happen. So one of them is going to happen. One of them or none of them, you know, at the end of the day.
Yeah, yeah. Do you still enjoy doing TV?
I do. You know, I like doing TV. The best part about doing TV is the people on the set.
Right.
You meet the cameramen, the editors, the producers. They're all people. They're all just working class people doing a privileged, skilled job. But at the end of the day, like the salt of the earth, the best, coolest guys to hang out with are the cameramen, the soundmen, and you know the producers are all great, and you get some inside track. So. From that point of view, that's why I really love it, is to get to meet those people that are putting the show together. And you can't help but learn hanging out with those people, especially if you're inquisitive and you develop a friendship with them and you talk. And so it's the in-between time, the friendships that are developed are cool. And then the other reason I often tell people, take these casting calls because you never know where they're going to go. You might, like for instance, Derek has got a very unique voice, a very unique character being from Boston. And he all the time, he's like, should I take the cast? I'm like, dude, you're going to end up on a beer commercial. You're going to make $100,000 in 10 minutes. So
that's cool.
You take the casting call, because the casting person is going to say, oh my God, that guy, Brandon, is perfect. He's like the perfect, like middle America guy with a kid. That's exactly what I need. So, yeah. You know, you might not be right for the project you spoke about, but you go into the roster and then one day you'll get a call. You're like, hey, do you like doing laundry? You're like, yeah, you know, and then all of a sudden you're on like a Tide commercial or something, you know,
right.
Which that would never happen if you didn't speak to that casting person. So it's for like the longer reaching planted seeds.
The networking part of it. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. So I had a couple questions that folks had sent in before. And so I've got, I think, a couple minutes, if that works for you. So Jonathan Casmosis,
I met him. Good dude.
Yeah, did you meet him at WorkBenchCon?
Yeah, we hung out. He's a great guy. I gave him a nice pick.
Yeah, he was on the show a little while ago. He's super nice. So getting into metalworking, what power tools are an absolute must? Bridgeport mill, lathe, belt sander, etc.
Oh, yeah, definitely all of the above. I mean, if you were going to just start and you didn't have anything, I would just say an angle grinder you can get through a lot with. An angle grinder and maybe even a bandsaw, and of course a welder. But an angle grinder and a bandsaw, and I say bandsaw, like the little handheld plumber bandsaws, like the ones that you see a lot, like kind of in a vise or on its own stand on a bench. I've been using one of those for the last 8 years. I just finally bought a dual bandsaw, something I've always wanted. The dual bandsaw is like a big machine shop bandsaw. And today I just picked up another bandsaw from Andrew at Blacksmith Tools. He sent me over another old Delta, which I have a few of now.
That's funny. All right, so that leads directly into our next question. This is from Anthony over on Bob Steam's Anthony Film Stuff.
Oh, yeah.
He said, how many bandsaws have you acquired in the last week?
let me see. I'm going to do a quick count. I got 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. I have at least 10 bandsaws right now.
Okay. And how many one of those?
In the last week, just one that I got this morning. I picked it up from YRC Freight. From Andrew. And then about, I guess the last one I got was the Dual, which I got about, I guess I got the Dual about 2 months ago. And then around the same time, I got the big giant one from Louisville. Yeah, it's fun. I love bandsaws.
Yeah, yeah. So I had Walker from Full Spectrum on a couple weeks back. For folks that don't know, he built a laser bandsaw, which I thought was a joke, and then all of a sudden he shows up. But he said that you were going to change it up, and actually, because it was on like some massive old one right now, right?
Yeah, it was on one of my old, it's called American Woodworking Tools bandsaw. It's a big 36-inch one. We just zip-tied it to that just to get the show going. Yeah. But now Andrew Blacksmith Tools sent me an old C-frame jigsaw it's an old Oliver jigsaw from turn of the century, and I'm gonna pull that apart and then set up the laser bandsaw on that. So that's going to be something. Yeah. So it'll be dedicated. So you can walk up, step on the foot pedal, and cut a piece of
that's
material.
Crazy.
Yeah, and you're going to go streaking. Is
that something you'd actually use? Like, it's not just like is a fun video. Okay.
I think if it was set up, it would get used more often than not. The one we set up was difficult because it was kind of going into winter. I couldn't leave the water in it. And, so I had to kind of dismantle it going into winter just so I could preserve the tube. But now that summer's here, I'm going to set it up in my shop and it's going to be upcoming video. Definitely.
That's crazy.
Yep.
Okay. So then the last one, this is from Josh over on Bob's team. So Josh likes to make stuff. I guess they're just reading Instagram instead of working. But if the making God required you to cut off another piece of you in order to keep making, what would it be?
Probably, how about we cut off my same pinky because it's not quite useful.
All the way off?
Yeah. How about we do that? We just get rid of the pinky altogether because it doesn't really work. I mean, you can see I'm showing my hand right now.
It
works from the joint just below where the cut happened, but anything from the cut forward, it's just a prop. My pinky doesn't really actually work. Like, that's as best it goes.
That's fun. That's crazy.
As opposed to this
How
pinky,
old is
which
that?
Is... That injury happened March 31st, 2010. So it's exactly 10 years ago.
10 years ago, yeah. That's crazy. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you.
No, folks will know exactly where to find you if they do. But are there any, do you have any projects that you're excited about that you'd want to send people to or anything you've built recently?
I just built a stool for Shaquille O'Neal, which was super fun. That was a great build.
That was cool.
A lot. That was like a lot of new fabrication techniques in there for me. And, it's funny because the guys that do riveting completely tear me apart. They're like, that's not riveting, you're horrible at riveting. I'm like, oh, okay, no credit for the 17 other things that I've done in this video. It's funny when I do something new. But the stool was great video, fun video. Knife making is a new thing to me still. Everyone thinks I'm a professional knife maker because they've seen me do a couple times, but knife making is still something I learn about every single time I do it. And what else? Blacksmithing, casting. I just recently cast a bunch of brass and I made a hammer out of it. I have I still have to make my bell. I started working on a bell that I was going to make, one for me, one for Bob. I'm going to do that too. That's coming up. I have the form. I just need the casting stuff. But yeah.
That's cool. Well, I appreciate your time and chatting.
Right on. I just, a little bit of advice to anybody starting out. Just, it always goes from free products to getting paid a little bit more, to getting paid a little bit more, to getting paid a little bit more. And that's how it goes. And if you develop relationships with these people, that's the best thing, to become friends with these advertisers. And this way you could have a comfortable negotiation. It doesn't get weird.
Yeah, it's a great way to end it. Great advice.
Thank you
so much.
Right on.
All right. Thanks for hanging out to the end of the show. This is where I give you a quick update about the things I've got going on inside of my shop. And if you can't tell, I'm actually recording from inside of my shop right now. So it might be a little echoey because I'm sitting in our garage in front of the computer. So there are a couple reasons for that. Now, the biggest is, so my wife is off for spring break. She is a teacher and our 2-year-old is also home as well. So I want to get out of their hair while we're recording. And then also I've been doing some course videos. So you guys might know that I've been putting together a course in Fusion 360 specifically for those of you that want to build furniture. So I'm recording those videos right now from the shop. We're going through Fusion and I'm going to be reopening that course a little bit later. And then on the actual making side of things, so it has been a little bit quiet this week. I've been off a couple days, but next week I'll be working on a laser review. Actually, I have two laser units that I need to get into. One that I'm super excited about is from Full Spectrum Laser. It is their Muse. It is their 3D unit. And so it's got a camera on it that can sense the depth of the material, and then it can auto adjust, which is pretty crazy. So we'll be getting into a full review of that. And I'll be kind of reworking my site so I can create full review pages. So all the products I've done in the past, I want to do nicer reviews where you can actually kind of walk through my rankings and my thoughts and everything. So it's not just a video, but it's a full out review. We'll have that up. And then I have another smaller, another one of those Auteur laser engravers. This one is their second version, which really is the same laser head, just on a bigger gantry to make it easier to do bigger stuff with it. So those are going to be coming soon. And then we're going to have some more builds after that. As always, I would love to know the things that you have going on. Be sure and hit me up over on Instagram at The Make or Break Shop. And until next time, go make or break something in your shop. See you guys.